Kia ora and welcome to Nerdman's Podcast, episode 266. Today is Thursday, October 20, 2011. Well, we are about to begin the Labor Weekend here in New Zealand, because Monday is the Labor Day holiday, the statutory holiday. But Nigel's decided to take off tomorrow, Friday, and also Tuesday, so he gets a nice long break. But because I never record when he's here in the house, that means I'm recording today. And so, yeah. Now, today's episode is called Dilemma Resolved, because I have finally decided who I'm voting for in the upcoming New Zealand elections. But before that, I've got some bits and pieces from the New Zealand news, as per usual. But before all of that, I have some personal updates. Nigel's mom has been up this week. She came up on Sunday, and she's staying here in Auckland. She stayed with us the first few days. She's staying with Nigel's sister at the moment, and then she'll come back here at the weekend, and we'll take her home probably on Monday and come back Tuesday and stay overnight down there. Or at least that's the plan at this stage. But the weather has been absolutely horrible this week. It's been cold and rainy and just really not pleasant at all until today. Today is bright and sunny, clear blue skies, birds are singing. It's a lovely day. Finally, we get a nice day, which means I can drive things out on the line too, and that's nice. But so we haven't actually been able to do a whole lot. We've managed to go to lunch every day. But apart from that, we haven't, you know, gone out and done stuff. We went to a garden center on Tuesday, I think it was, with Nigel's sister, because she's looking for some trees for her section. But by and large, we actually haven't done all that much. It's actually not all that bad, really. It's kind of nice. Now, Sunday day, before they arrived, Nigel and I went out and ran some errands and things. And among other things, I got this fancy attachment for the wardrobe system I put in. It's, it sort of looks like the slide for a trombone, but it's got hooks on it for ties or belts. And it snaps, well, hooks onto the shelving system. So I put that in because Nigel's ties were all looped around a hanger, just ordinary, well, it's actually a jacket hanger. And I had a couple belts hooked on the hanger that some pants of mine were on, which meant they had to be in the long space. They couldn't be in the shorter one because the belts are too long. So now everything's all nice, neat, and tidy, and it looks very good. It looks much better. So I was very happy about that, which means that I'm one step closer to getting the wardrobe all sorted. But I'm still washing all the things that used to be in there, and that takes forever, particularly when it's a rainy day because I have to dry things in the dryer, and I'm trying to avoid that. So, yeah. So this ongoing project is still ongoing. But I've at least decided the wardrobe I'm going to organize next. So I've got a plan for how I'm going to be doing things. But, of course, a lot of this stuff, well, you know that all of my – I'm turning to pick up a piece of paper. All of my projects are built around my work schedule, as you know. But now there's a new complication. I received a jury summons. I'm to report there for jury duty on Monday, the 14th of November at 8:45 a.m. Now, the way it works in New Zealand is you go to these things, and you could be dismissed that day. I mean, that's pretty much the same as I experienced in Illinois. And if you are, then you're off the hook for 2 years. However, you may not be, and you may be required to turn up every day at the same time all week long. If at the end of the week you still haven't been selected or dismissed, then you are dismissed at the end of the week. So it's only 1 week you've got to do this. And the selection part, I think, is fairly quick. Some of the trials that they are selecting for will last a week, but one of them will last 4 weeks. And that's what the problem is, because if I was selected for a trial that lasted a week, I could do that easily. But if it's one that's for 4 weeks, I can't, because it would overlap my work project, and I'm the only one who can do that project. There is nobody else. And if I don't do it, it's not going to happen. And that causes all sorts of other problems. So I'm not exactly sure what to do. I thought about trying to see if I could delay it for a month until December, because I don't have the work project. Once I finish it in December, that's it. So if it lasts 4 weeks and goes into January, which it wouldn't, it's not a problem. But I don't know. I have been told I should just show up, and then if I get selected for the one that's up to 4 weeks, to say I've got this conflict, and I would probably be dismissed. I don't know. So I think I've got to ring up the Ministry of Justice and find out what to do. I don't like jury duty, never have, but that's a whole topic unto itself. But yeah, that's something I've got to deal with. But on the other hand, if I'm forced to do it, at least I'd have something to blog about and to talk about on the podcast after the fact, of course, because when in New Zealand, juries are never sequestered, and you go home at the end of the day. You're not supposed to talk about the trial. You're not allowed to watch the news or read a newspaper and all that sort of stuff until the trial's over. And because then you can find out on what you missed, but which is a bit of a drag because, you know, I like to know what's going on, and I won't even be able to listen to my news podcasts. No, I probably can't if they're American because they don't talk about New Zealand news at all. But anyway, be that as it may. Where was I? Oh, yes. So that's pretty much what I've been up to lately. I'm just trying to think if I have anything else in the pipeline, and I don't. I just have been mostly busy with Nigel's mom being here and also the organization project and all that sort of stuff. But that's really been about it. Now, in the news, we do have news here in New Zealand, apart from me. I don't know why, but there is. Now, of course, the major news is something that most people have probably already heard about, and that's the ship that's run into a reef near the port of Tauranga. The reef, the Astrolabe Reef, is well known. It's well charted. The last time a ship ran aground there was something like 1878 or something like that. So it's not like it's a, oh my goodness me, I didn't know that was there sort of thing. Everybody knew it was there, so there's no excuse for the ship running aground. And ultimately somebody will be held criminally liable, probably. The ship master, or captain, or whatever the heck you call it, and his first officer are in custody at the moment and are facing charges. Several of the other crew members have already been sent home. I can't tell you who the master of the ship and first officer are because there is a suppression order in place here in New Zealand, which means that their names and details about them can't be publicized here in New Zealand, even though it's already been released overseas and their government has talked about them by name. So I won't be talking about them, but if you do Google it, you can find it out for yourself, because everybody else in the world can find out who these people are. It's just we can't because the government is apparently, or the courts are apparently convinced that they would face violence if the New Zealand public knew who they were, which I think is silly because New Zealand public can find out who they are anyway. It's just, that's another topic in itself too. But so the ship is still aground and it will break up. It has been dumping copious amounts of fuel oil into the harbor, into the water, and the oil has been washing up all the way from Mount Maunganui to, all the way up to the beach where a movie called Boy was filmed. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it was filmed there. And all kinds of other things. Basically, the entire northeastern part of the North Island, the beaches have had some oil wash up, or containers, or both. And it's just an unmitigated disaster. Now, there have been several people who've said that it wouldn't have been any different if Labour had been in government, that they would have been, it's more of a rhetorical question, would they have been any better? And the short answer is, who knows? Because they're not in power, so we can't possibly know if they would have been better. I tend to think that they probably would have been, only because they, historically, have been more aware of how short-term events can affect an election outcome, and we're only at the time that it ran aground, about 7 weeks away from the election, six or seven weeks. And so if Labour had been in government, they would have been keenly aware of the need to be seen as moving quickly because of that election. National, historically, has not been quite as switched on about that sort of thing. So in that sense, I think Labour probably would have been better. But the larger issue is, how did this happen? And the answer to that is that there was no plan in place for any kind of maritime disaster, whether in this case a ship running aground or a deep sea oil drilling platform blowing up or whatever, sort of like Deepwater Horizon. And the problem is that this government wants to start deepwater drilling off that coast, and I believe other places in New Zealand. And they declared in the House that they had plans in place that would be, not state of the art, but industry standard or whatever it's called, best practice, I think is what they were using, for dealing with dealing with an emergency should there be a problem with an oil well. Well, it's now obvious that they had no plan whatsoever. They either deliberately misled the House, which is a very serious offense, or they didn't know what they were talking about, which is equally possible, to be honest. Oh, there's the special appearance by Sunny the dog, without which no podcast would be complete. But So they didn't have a plan for dealing with it, and they couldn't operate on the fly to try to come up with one. And that's kind of typical of the way they've been operating in these various crises that they've faced. They try to put it together on an ad hoc basis, and they really struggle to deal with the disaster as it happens. The other issue is that New Zealand has not signed the maritime treaty that deals with these sorts of things. So the damages that the ship's owners are going to have to pay top out at something like $14 million or whatever, which is a fraction of what it's going to cost to clean all this up. And Labor pointed out that National hasn't signed it, and National said, well, Labor never did anything about it when they were in government. And that's true, except it's also irrelevant because the National Party is in power. They are now responsible for that sort of thing. They can't just say, well, our predecessors didn't do it. That's not good enough. They should have done it, especially because they want to have deep water drilling. You would think that the logical thing would be to make sure that they have a strategy in place for dealing with a disaster that they could point to. So if people raise questions, but unfortunately, I guess not enough people raised the right questions to reveal in advance that the government had no plan for dealing with this, for dealing with such emergencies. And by the way, a well blowing up would be many times the level of disaster that the ship is, and the ship is the worst maritime disaster in New Zealand history. And so, you know, we've got 14,000 kilometers of coastline, give or take, and we don't have a maritime disaster plan, which is a real concern. And they also found out, as this disaster was unfolding, that there's no helicopter in New Zealand strong enough to lift containers off of the ship to get them so they don't go, you know, breaking up in the ocean or sinking or floating or whatever, causing shipping hazards. And as if all of that weren't enough, this particular government did nothing for the better part of 5 days. You know, the ship was run aground in the reef. It was stuck. It was there in calm seas for 4 days. And the fifth day, the weather started turning a bit. But in all that time, the government did nothing. They could have done, they could have started pumping the fuel out, but they turned that down because they said it would have taken too many trips. So instead of having some of it pumped out so that at least that much wouldn't wash on the shores, they're risking having most of it wash on the shores. Yeah, the ineptitude of this government just never ceases to surprise me. And it's not just on this, it's on so many other things. The Transport Minister, Stephen Joyce, is arrogant. And when the disaster first happened, he treated anybody who questioned him or the government as if they were the most despicable human being ever, instead of the fact that they were asking legitimate questions. The Prime Minister snapped at a press conference and said to the reporters, well, what would you have done that would have been any better? And practically in that tone of voice. And it didn't do his reputation any good because he's not someone who likes to be challenged. He doesn't like people to question his abilities, question his ability to manage a government. He likes all the photo ops. He likes to smile and wave and have his goofy grin and his large entourage. But he doesn't like the nuts and bolts of governing, and he certainly doesn't like to be held to account when things go wrong. And we saw that in abundance with this disaster. And he has been considered the strongest piece of the National Party's re-election campaign. His photo was on every poster, even for local electorate candidates. And it could very well end up backfiring if people continue to blame him or look badly at him personally, as well as his party and the government that they're running. But, of course, that we will see over the coming weeks. Now, this is a significant day in New Zealand because today, this is shifting into my next topic now, but it's related to the news, Parliament was officially dissolved, the 49th Parliament. The way it works is that the Governor-General issues a proclamation declaring that the Parliament is dissolved in preparation for the elections, and his deputy, I've forgotten, Herald at Arms or some weird title like that, stands on the steps of Parliament and reads the proclamation witnessed by people associated with the House, clerk and deputy clerk or something. Anyway, and the other way it can be dissolved is if they publish it in the official register. But they first read it on the steps in, I think it was 87 or something like that, and they started it a few parliaments ago. They started doing it, and it's become this sort of tradition, which is interesting because I never heard about it until now. But apparently that's now the way they do things. Now, the Governor General is the only one who has the authority to dissolve Parliament. The Governor General is, of course, the Queen's representative here in New Zealand. So technically, it's the reigning monarch who has the authority delegated to the Governor General. The House can't dissolve itself. However, the Governor General only acts on the advice of the Prime Minister, who is, of course, the leader of the largest party in the House of Representatives or Parliament. Same thing, because we only have one House, remember. So that's a significant thing for today. Now, 1 week from yesterday, Wednesday, the 26th, is the deadline for registering to vote for the election. It's exactly a month out from the election, because the election is Saturday, November 26th. But here's the thing that's kind of odd about that. It is the date to be registered to be published in the rolls. And they used to say that the rolls are closed for printing. And that's true, sort of. I imagine they still do print the rolls for use in polling places and things. But the real effect of it is that they send out this thing they call an easy vote card to all the registered voters. And an easy vote card is kind of like a voter ID card where I'm from in Illinois. But it has your name and where you're registered so that they can look you up quickly and cross you off the list. Because unlike the U.S., you don't vote in a specific precinct or whatever. You can vote anywhere in your electorate. You can actually vote anywhere in New Zealand, but you have to do what's called a special vote. And it can be a little bit dicey for things like Member of Parliament, because I think they have to have a booklet of all the candidates and all the electorates or something, I don't know. And special votes take a few days after the election to count. Also, if you fail to register before before Wednesday the 26th, before that deadline, you actually can still vote if you register ahead of time. I think you have to register ahead of time. You can't register on the day, but you can register right up until Friday, the 25th of November. But then you have to cast a special vote. So technically speaking, there is no voter registration deadline. Well, 24 hours, I guess, is the deadline. And I find that fascinating. And, of course, in New Zealand, all permanent residents and citizens have the right to vote in all elections. But only citizens can run for office, public office, whether it's national or local. That part doesn't matter. So these are some of the things that are coming up. And also, just a little side note in history. Yesterday was the 45th anniversary of the arrival of Lyndon Baines Johnson in New Zealand. He was here for basically 24 hours. It was the first visit to New Zealand by a U.S. president, and it apparently was very well received. He got good crowds. He had some protesters in Wellington. I think it was at the airport. I'm not really sure. Anyway, somewhere he had some protesters who were protesting the Vietnam War. However, they were largely drowned out by other people, by New Zealanders who were there, and the press at the time expressed their open contempt for the protesters. So it's kind of interesting how things have changed. Speaking of protesters, we have Occupy protesters here in Auckland now, and they are taking up a part of Aotea Square. Now, I am going to be posting a blog post about this, and I'm also talking about it on the latest two political podcasts, so you can find out more about that on either one. But something that I've just found out today, a few minutes ago, is, all of these encampments have a kitchen. And under New Zealand law, all places that prepare food for public consumption have to be inspected. And they inspected their food facilities at this camp, and they gave it an A rating, which is the highest you can get. And I think that's kind of funny in a weird sort of way. I don't know. It amuses me. But that's some of the news, personal and country, that has caught my eye over the past week or so. Now on to my main topic, which is my dilemma. As you may recall from earlier episodes, I was unsure who I was going to vote for this year. The only thing I knew for certain was that I was going to vote to keep MMP as our voting system in the referendum. We have a two-part referendum next month. Part A says I want to keep MMP, or no, I want to change to something else. And then part B is, if New Zealand's system were to change, which one would be your preference? And there are several different options that somebody can choose to vote for. And if a majority of people vote in Part A that they want to keep MMP, that's the end of it. But an independent inquiry is launched to look at ways of improving MMP to make it better than it is. If it fails to win a majority in Part A, then there will be a runoff between MMP and whatever the top preference is in Part B. And then if in that one the other system wins, then it won't take effect until the next election after that. So this is 2011. The next referendum would be, 2014, I guess. 11, 12, 13, yeah, 14. And then the first election under the new system would be in 2016. So that's how this whole process works. At the moment, it's expected that MMP is going to win, approval, I guess you'd say, or retention or whatever. I'm certainly voting for it because it is the fairest and most democratic voting system I've seen anywhere, primarily because it is proportional. It ensures that the makeup of parliament precisely matches the percentage that each party gets, with some minor little issues like the minimum, you have to get 5% of the popular vote. And I can talk about the pluses and minuses about MMP another time. But basically, that was the one thing I knew for certain, that I was going to vote to keep MMP. I've known that all along. There was never any question in my mind. The question was, who was I going to give my party vote to? Because remember, we get two votes, party vote and electorate, the person to represent us in our electorate. And the electorate vote was every bit as uncertain, but in some ways less important. Of the two votes, your party vote is the most important because that determines the makeup of parliament. The more votes a party gets, the greater the number of seats it has in parliament. So in that sense, the electorate vote doesn't matter that much. And so I was faced with the current MP, who is a National Party MP. This is the electorate vote we're talking about now. And I don't particularly like him, and I wasn't going to vote for him. That wasn't an option. The Labour candidate I don't like, and I didn't want to vote for her. So I thought, well, maybe the Greens candidate. Well, I found out about him since I didn't know that there was one, to be honest. I did some research and found out there is one. He is from New South Wales, which that doesn't matter, but he lives in Auckland Central on the other side of the bridge, and that does matter to me because he doesn't live in the electorate now, and which means he doesn't really know the electorate. But the bigger issue for me is that he listed as his primary interest, legislative interest, animal welfare. Now, I'm all for animal welfare. I think animals should be treated well and so on. I don't know that he really means that. He may mean other issues related to animals. I'm not sure. But quite frankly, in the midst of the worst global financial setback since the Great Depression, when record numbers of people are leaving each year to move to Australia, when unemployment remains stubbornly high, when house prices are stagnant, and all these other financial problems, wages are virtually frozen, all of these problems that ordinary Kiwis are facing, I personally prefer to see human issues higher up on the priority list, and I'm just not willing to go there. So I'm going to end up, I don't want to say voting for the Labour candidate, but I will be putting a tick next to her name sort of by default of the fact that of the options available to me, she's the least objectionable, which isn't saying much because I don't like any of them. So, but that relates to the second part, party vote. And that's the one I have struggled with intensely for months on end. Over the past 3 years, the Labour opposition has done a lot of things that have really pissed me off. And I've never been a huge fan of Phil Goff, certainly not since he became leader. And some of the MPs have done some really stupid things and said some really stupid things. I am disappointed that the party still isn't out in front calling for marriage equality, although they have announced that they're going to do adoption equality. It's not nearly as important as marriage equality, but it is important. And other issues related to that, and they're a bit too conservative for me. I want them to be a bit more to the left. So I was considering giving my party vote to the Greens so that it might pull, if they formed a coalition with Labour, it would pull Labour to the left, which is what I want. However, I've thought about this endlessly, and every time I get mad at Labour about some stupid policy that they're doing, I thought about doing that. But now I have decided firmly that I am going to give my party vote to Labour. And here's why. Two issues. The first, it relates to the electorate vote, and it also relates to what I've been telling people in back in the U.S., my friends and associates back in the U.S. I know plenty of liberal Democrats who are disgusted with the Democratic Party and President Obama, and they say, I'm not going to vote for any Democrat, or I'm not going to give any money to the Democrats because they're not liberal enough, or they're surrendering to the Republicans all the time. And I keep saying, what's your alternative? Because in the U.S., only one or two parties is going to get elected, certainly on the national level, but very often on the state and local level as well, or state level as well. And that's a Republican or a Democrat. You're not going to get a third party. A third party person cannot be elected president. The system is set up to prevent that. And it's highly improbable that in most places, anybody but a Republican or Democrat will get elected any statewide office or to the U.S. House even. So given that reality, if you don't vote for the Democrat, you're effectively voting for the Republican, even if you don't vote at all. Or if you vote for some bizarre third party like the, I don't know, the Underwater Basket Weavers Party. I'm making that up, just in case you didn't know. because that's the way the system works. The American system is set up to ensure that Republicans or Democrats are elected. And to me, that's self-defeating. As a liberal Democrat, the last thing in the world I want is a right-wing fundamentalist Republican elected to any office. And I would not do anything by omission or commission to make that happen, which is essentially what people are doing when they say, I'm not going to support any Democrats because they're not doing this, that, or the other thing that I want. Well, I got to thinking about that as it applies to New Zealand, because as I said, I do not like the Labour Party candidate. But by that point, I sort of sat out. My contributions to the party had lapsed, and so my membership had lapsed, and I wasn't able to take part in the selection process. That's my fault. If I had been still involved with the party at that point, if my membership had been in good standing, I could have taken part in the selection process, and I could have argued against this particular person being selected. Or I could have worked for somebody else, or what have you. The point is that it's all because I wasn't personally involved in the party that that all of this happened and why I was unhappy with it. Because, I mean, if she had been selected anyway, I would have been unhappy about that. But at least I would have known that I did what I could to try to prevent that from happening. Whereas most people, and this is true in New Zealand and the U.S., most people complain about the parties from the outside or from the sidelines, and they don't do anything to try to change it. And, you know, I want to be the change that I want to see. And what I mean by that is that I want to try to do what I can to try to influence the party in the direction I want it to go. And because I'm in New Zealand, that's what I'm going to get involved in. I'm not going to get involved in the Democratic Party. But people who are unhappy with the Democratic Party should get involved in their local party. They should consider running for an office in their local party, or perhaps for elective office if they can do that. Basically, they should take responsibility for creating the change that they want to see, for being the change that they want to see. And so that's what brought me back to Labour and to agree to give the electorate vote to the Labour candidate, even though I don't like her. Because what I want is I want a Labour-led government. And the only way to do that is to vote for Labour. Now, I did say that I considered giving my vote to the Greens because I wanted them to pull Labour to the left. And if there was a Labour-Green coalition, that's certainly what would happen. But there's a problem there. The Greens will not rule out doing a coalition government with the Conservative National Party. Now, I want a change of government. I don't want another National Party-led government. So I cannot take the chance that my vote, which I might do to try to drag Labour to the left, would end up reelecting a national-led government. Because the Greens, if they had a formal coalition with National, and they admit that it's highly unlikely that that would happen, but if they did, they would not get all of their policies enacted. I mean, in this government, the ACT Party didn't. They got many of them, but not all of them. And it's doubtful that the Greens could prevent the National Party from doing the things that would be the worst things that they're planning on doing. So given all of that, given the fact that I did nothing to try to make Labour be the way I want it to be, and the fact that doing anything other than voting for Labour could contribute to a National Party government winning this election, I was left ultimately with the clear decision that I needed to give my electorate vote to the Labour Party candidate and to give my party vote to the New Zealand Labour Party, and that's what I decided to do, and that's why. So it's directly related to advice I've been giving for years, it seems, about the political situation in the U.S., and it's also related specifically to specific events here in New Zealand. And it actually kind of fascinates me the way the two have sort of intertwined like that. So that's where I'm at the moment, and that's what I'm in the midst of doing. Now, I do have some phone messages, but first I have an email I wanted to share. It's from a listener named Rachel who writes, "Hi, Arthur, I apologize if you've answered these questions before, but do you file taxes in New Zealand in the same manner as the U.S.? Like, is it done after the first of the year with a deadline of a few months? Also, does the government over there have programs like the U.S.'s food stamps, WIC, and others for low-income people families?" Well, it's a sort of a complicated question, so I'll try to break it down simply. For taxes, there's two issues there. One is for American citizens living anywhere in the world, American citizens are required to report their worldwide income every year. And that doesn't matter if they're not living in the U.S., if they're a permanent resident, or even a citizen of another country. As long as they are a citizen of the United States, they must file income tax return. And by the way, the United States government doesn't consider tax liability a legitimate reason for renouncing your U.S. citizenship. So if you do become a citizen of another country and then you try to renounce your citizenship, and in their opinion it's to avoid taxes, they won't recognize it. And this becomes a real legal problem. U.S. citizens, if they don't file their tax return, could have trouble entering the United States, say, to visit family or friends or whatever. And they theoretically could even face arrest for it, depending on circumstances. So it is a really good idea to file the tax returns. Now, Americans living overseas get an automatic 3-month extension, I think it is. March, April, May. Yeah, 3-month extension. You have to file a special form to do that. And you have to file that by April 15th, but you do get an automatic three-month extension. But it's really not necessary. You can do the paperwork yourself to get everything all organized. The problem is that New Zealand's fiscal year is not the same as the U.S. It runs from April 1st to March 31st. And that's the tax year, that's the financial year, everything runs on that schedule. So you have to keep your own set of records for what's liable in what year. For tax purposes. Now, New Zealand has a tax treaty with the U.S., which means that American citizens living in New Zealand essentially can choose which country they're going to pay taxes to. If they're only in New Zealand short term, say a year, 6 months, 18 months, whatever, they're going to pay U.S. income taxes because they're going to be returning to the U.S. in a short period. But if they're living in New Zealand permanently, then they're going to be paying their taxes to New Zealand, because why would you pay taxes to the U.S.? And if you are a permanent resident, I think you pretty much have to pay taxes here. Once you become a permanent resident, that's pretty much it. You're here. Now, the ordinary taxpayer does not file a tax return. The system is fine-tuned enough that your money is deducted from your pay. It goes to the Inland Revenue, IRD. And then that's it. You don't have to file a return. You don't get anything back. That's just it. There are very few tax deductions available to New Zealand taxpayers. Charities are one of them. And people with exceptional circumstances would have to file a tax return if they have certain investment income. Well, actually, if they do have investment income, they probably need to. If they're self-employed or if they own and run a business, they would probably have to do that. Well, they would have to do that. And certain other unique circumstances, they may have to do that. But for the vast majority of income taxpayers, they don't file a return. They don't get a refund. Everything just goes around perfectly. Now, you can always check to see the status of your account. Your employer is required to give you a payslip, which will show the status of your deductions, your year-to-date, and all that sort of thing. And you can check online to make sure they match. And they damn well better. Your employer is in big trouble. So you really don't need to worry about it. Now, as far as government programs for low-income people, there are a number of them, and they are only open to permanent residents and citizens. They're not open to anyone on a work visa or temporary visa. So if somebody is here and on a work visa and they lose their job, generally speaking, they have to leave the country. There may be charities who are willing to help out, but the government doesn't have any programs to help them. We do not have food stamps at present. The general benefit is what's often called the DOL, but it's the Domestic Purposes Benefit, the DPB. There's an unemployment benefit. There's a sickness benefit. There's, of course, pensions. There's a student allowance of some sort. I don't really know much about that one. And they give cash payments, much like a job does. They're very low and barely subsistence, to be honest. And many families have to supplement their benefits with things like food pantries and so on. It's not intended to be a easy to live on that. But like U.S. welfare used to be, there's additional benefits for additional children and so on. Now, there has been talk about putting food onto a card system, similar to a food stamps thing, but basically you could use the card and you could use it only to buy food. Because apparently what some people were doing was they were going to the grocery store and they were using their money for other things like alcohol and gambling and cigarettes and stuff like that. And they feel that would be a way around it. It's awfully paternalistic. And it seems to me it would make more sense to teach them how to budget responsibly than it would be to treat them like children. But that's what the National Party is proposing to do, precisely what they're proposing to do. So we don't have food stamps. No, it's just a lump sum cash payment. There is another one that's called Working for Families, which is actually for better off families, working families, but more towards the middle class end of the spectrum and below. And the national government has cut that back already, and they would like to eliminate it altogether because they argue that it's middle class welfare. Well, it's a matter of perspective. And it has been a highly successful program. It basically gives parents with children a benefit to – I actually don't know what the original purpose was, but it was to keep them from sliding into poverty, certainly. And but that's for more middle-income people. There is, of course, there are all sorts of benefits for lower-income people. But as I say, they are limited to permanent residents and citizens. And I'm actually not even sure which ones specifically are available to permanent residents. I know that unemployment is. Because you no longer need a work permit, obviously. Once you're a permanent resident, you also qualify for free treatment in hospitals and free schooling and stuff like that. When you're a temporary resident, there are restrictions on all of that stuff. I don't know what they are because, well, first of all, I became a permanent resident a long time ago, a citizen even a long time ago, and also because I never used any of the services back then, so I never had any personal knowledge of them. But thank you for that, Rachel. And I just thought I would share that because I thought other people may have similar questions. But now I'm going to go on to the phone messages. And the first one is from Roger Green.
Oh, dear, Arthur, you talked about cleaning your house and it made me depressed because it reminds me of the chain of events that needs to take place before my house can ever get clean. And it was sort of sad and depressing. I'll have to write about it, I guess. Anyway, this is Roger. Bye.
Well, thanks for that, Roger. And yes, I get very depressed about that, as you know. However, I'm not going to talk about it at all on my blog. I'm only talking about it here on the podcast. And so you have the field free to yourself for writing about that very same subject. Well, thanks, Roger. And next up is a call from Bank.
Hi, Arthur. It's Bank here. Hope you're well, and I've been enjoying your podcasts. I was inspired by your most recent one to go clean out my dresser, so I hope you know that there are now piles of clothes all over my bedroom floor and that you are responsible for this. I think it's progress. I hope so. Anyway, calling with a few thoughts. Well, one question I want to ask and one thing I want to say. So I don't know if John Key is a scumbag or not, but he sure is a dickhead, if I'm allowed to say that. I think he's been reading his own publicity and coming to believe it, and he thinks he can do no wrong. And that's, yeah, he's definitely behaving badly, and I think he thinks he can get away with never having to say sorry. So, so much for him. And then the other thing that's on my mind is the Rugby World Cup. We're watching it here. We have to watch the games delayed, and that means that I have to studiously avoid all sources of New Zealand news between the time that the games are played and when we get to watch them. So it's been kind of a pain, but we're enjoying it a lot. And I didn't grow up watching rugby at all. In fact, I grew up not watching rugby, and I was a teenager during the 81 tour by the Springboks, and, you know, that was a huge deal in my childhood there. But now, here I am enjoying watching the rugby so much, and who knew? I managed to have a 10-minute conversation about Colin Slade's groin this morning, which I would not have expected. And I was wondering, who's watching rugby these days, and rugby union in particular? Is it, you mentioned that there's a class divide between union and league, but is there a political or an age divide in who follows rugby union and who doesn't follow any form of rugby or who follows league and so on? Is that still there? Because when I was young, it kind of said something about your politics, whether you watched rugby or not. Anyway, just curious as to whether you've made any observations about that, and I'll look forward to your next podcast. Okay, bye-bye.
Well, thanks for that, Bank. And I tend to agree with you. I personally don't think that I would use the word scumbag to describe John Key, except on that one occasion, his outburst against labor was a bit of a scumbag. But he certainly is a dickhead. And I've often said that I wish that all New Zealanders were required to watch Question Time at least with him in there at least once, because then they would see the real John Key and what an arrogant prick he really is. And he's not a nice man. He's thought of as that nice Mr. Key, but he's not. He really is not. And I was talking earlier about his performance during the Rena disaster, the early days, and how arrogant and short-tempered he was. And I'm quite certain that the reason for that is that he does not like being challenged, questioned, or for people to suggest that maybe he's not doing things correctly. He's only happy when people are worshiping at his feet, and there's plenty of people who don't and won't. And I think that the Rena disaster has sort of awakened a lot of people to maybe the real John Key, or what a lightweight he really is. There are a lot of people who have been really upset with him over the way he handled the Pike River disaster, promising things that could not be delivered. He promised the families that the bodies of their loved ones would be brought out of the mine. He cannot deliver on that. Nobody can. It may never happen even. He made all sorts of promises about Christchurch that he cannot deliver on. So, and now we have the Rena disaster. So Well, the whole election actually is taking a different turn because of all these developments. But I think you're right. I think he's more of a dickhead than a scumbag, personally. But as for rugby, funny you should say that, because I was just thinking about a lot of those things over the past week or so, probably because of all the hype heading up towards the final. Well, the semifinal was even worse. But when I arrived in New Zealand, I noticed there was a distinct divide between those who watched rugby and those who watched other sports. Last time I talked about the difference between rugby union and rugby league, but there was also a distinct difference between those who liked cricket and those who liked rugby. Now, of course, cricket at that time was a summer game, and rugby was an autumn and winter game. It's now changed. Rugby actually starts in the summer now. But at that time, that's the way it was. And at that time, the rugby matches were on free-to-air television. They were on TV1. Some years after I arrived here, I don't remember how many, all of the rugby matches moved, the live matches, moved to Sky Sport. And Sky is our pay TV operator. And so you had to subscribe to Sky Sport in order to be able to watch the rugby matches live. And then one broadcaster or the other, either TV1 or TV3, would rebroadcast the games on a delayed basis here in New Zealand. But as the years have passed, the viewership has started to decline. And so very often games are not live, or they're not rebroadcast, I should say, on the free-to-air channels anymore. And so very often the free-to-air channel that they end up on is called Prime, which is actually owned by Sky. So, or Māori TV, which is sort of a public service channel. And so a lot of people just don't watch rugby anymore on television. Now, the Rugby World Cup is an animal completely unto itself. I mean, the entire country is interested in this. They're watching rugby. They're able to talk about the game like they're, you know, long-term pundits, even if they haven't watched rugby in years. And you're not alone, Bank. A lot of New Zealanders are talking about various rugby players' groins. and not in a lascivious way necessarily, but but seriously, people are talking about things as if they know what they're talking about. And it's actually kind of funny to watch all these non-rugby people talking about these things. But in, as a general rule, overall, there has been a decline in the interest in rugby, driven, I think, by its move to pay TV originally. But and the basically class divide that used to exist between those who liked rugby, which was a largely working class or rural. So you had this odd mixture of working class labor voters and rural national voters, and cricket, which was more of an upmarket kind of sport. Well, all of that's changed now, and they're both more democratic, and neither one of them is watched nearly as much as they were. Well, the cricket is partly because the Black Caps have been so useless. I digress. Black Caps are a national cricket team, by the way, for those who don't know. So there isn't a particular political or class divide within rugby union as to those who watch and those who don't. Just as I said, in general, the viewership has been declining for the past 10 years easily. And if not, well, now probably about 10 years. And it's not quite as important as it used to be, except when the Rugby World Cup is on and everybody pays attention. Now, here in New Zealand, we have what's called the Tri Nations, which is an annual sporting national rugby sporting matches, test matches, they're called, between Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. Now, from next year, it's going to be the Four Nations because Argentina is joining the competition. And whether or not that increases interest or diminishes it, I don't know, obviously. We'll have to wait and see. But that does start next year, and it might make more people interested for the first year. Anecdotally, I can say that there is evidence that young the boys of European descent, Pakeha we call them, are playing soccer rather than rugby because their mothers are trying to protect them from the larger Polynesian boys. Because Polynesian boys, whether they're Māori or Pacific Islander in particular, they mature physically faster. They grow taller faster than the boys of European descent. And so they're bigger at the same age. And the mothers want to protect their sons from damage. So they've been having them play soccer. And kids tend to be interested in what they participate in. And so there has been a bit of a growing interest in soccer and a bit of a declining interest in rugby. Whether that's actually correlated or coincidental, I don't know. I don't think anybody's done any research. But it certainly is true. And so we'll see what happens with that over time, I suppose. But, so sports is not as important as it used to be in New Zealand. It still is important, and there are those who want to make it important, which is a topic in itself. But I have seen an obvious decline in the interest in rugby and the level of support for rugby and all of those sorts of things. But I can now say that there is no particular class or political divide among those who watch rugby union. But there is between those who watch rugby union and those who watch rugby league. They do tend to be distinct groups. Rugby league tends to be browner and more working class than rugby union tends to be. But at the moment, because we're in the Rugby World Cup and New Zealand is in the finals this coming Sunday, we're all behind the All Blacks. Go the ABs! Yes, well, we all hope they win. This is the first time since 1987, and that matchup was also against France. And yeah. Hopefully things will turn out well. Now, Sunday is meant to be Nigel's third colony show on farpointradio.com, and that would be at 9 p.m. Eastern time on Saturday or 2 p.m. Sunday here in New Zealand. And I asked him if he's planning on doing it, and I believe he is. So, you know, do keep an eye out for that. I'll certainly be tweeting about it. I imagine he will as well. I actually don't see why he wouldn't be doing it, because the finals of the Rugby World Cup aren't for hours after that, so it'll be good to have a distraction. So that may be this Sunday. That's something to look out for. Well, that is it for today, and that's it for this week. I'll be back next week with more, probably about a week from today, more or less, give or take. But have a great weekend, everybody, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye.
You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Airman's Podcast at airmanspodcast.com. You can send an email to me at Arthur, that's A-R-T-H-U-R, at amrenspodcast.com, or you can ring my U.S. comment line on 206-666-5172. This podcast is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.